Good evening, everybody. My pleasure to welcome you all here this evening. The school is extremely proud that it's been awarded the Queen's Anniversary Prize for Higher Education because of the work done in the Centre for Economic Performance. The CEP has been one of the world's leading centres for the study of unemployment and inequality, productivity and international trade, and its work has had a huge impact on government policy in Britain and other European countries. The prize has been awarded for that work after a long process of evaluation in which the Queen's Prize Council takes detailed evidence over a period of months and then makes recommendations to the Prime Minister, who in turn advises the Queen. I'd like to pay a personal tribute to the Centre, which has been a flagship for the school, and to offer my congratulations to the staff for what they've achieved. And I'd like to congratulate personally Richard Layard, sitting there in the fourth row back, something like that, and Nigel and all their colleagues for this. It's a fantastic achievement for the LSE and for the Centre. So why don't you give them all a bit of a clap? We thought that to celebrate this achievement, we should put on a series of lectures by distinguished economists on current economic issues relevant to the future of Europe and this country. The list of lectures which has been organized is truly amazing. I don't know how many people have got this lecture list, but after tonight's lecture, there is Peter Kennan, who's speaking on February the 18th. You might like to note that in your diaries if you don't have it in there already. Willem Buiten after that, Paul Krugman, Alan Kruger, John Kay, Sushil Wadhwani, and Norbert Walker, a truly formidable lineup, and I think you also deserve our congratulations, Richard, for having assembled such a list of luminaries to celebrate this achievement. Very appropriately, Adair Turner is sitting there smoothing his red tie to give the first lecture today. Adair is chairman of the Policy Committee of the Centre and knows it very well. He is a visiting professor at the school, and last year he wrote a very influential book, Just Capital, which I have to say I read in detail and I thought one of the most interesting books of the last few years. He was formerly Director General of the CBI and is currently Senior Advisor and Vice Chairman of Merrill Lynch, as well as being Chair of the Low Pay Commission. How those two things are compatible, I'm not so sure. Would you please give him a very warm welcome tonight?
Well, Tony, thank you very much for that introduction. Being at an investment bank and being chair of the Low Pay Commission was completely incompatible till about 2 years ago, since when investment banking has been in complete freefall, so it's approaching but not yet at a point of compatibility. I'd just like to say how very pleased I am to be giving the first of these Queen's Prize lectures, because I have been a great admirer over the years of the work of the Centre for Economic Performance, which I think has really led the way globally in terms of looking at some issues to do with productivity, education, unemployment, and issues of that sort, and has been a very major influence on a UK government and European government policy. It's about European economic policy that I'd like to talk this evening. And my title is What's Wrong with Europe's Economy? And clearly, I start with the assumption something is wrong. 2 years ago, in early 2001, there was a great deal of confidence about Europe's prospects relative to the US. The euro had been successfully launched. Its impact on intra-European trade and industrial restructuring was already apparent. And the difficult period of pre-launch fiscal consolidation seemed to lie in the past. The US, with far greater personal exposure to stock market investment, looked like the economy likely to be more vulnerable to the bust of the dot-com boom. And all of the major forecasts in January 2001 foresaw more rapid Eurozone growth over the subsequent 2 years, the last 2 years now, than American growth in 2001 and 2002. And over the last 2 years, it is the US which has suffered more from unexpected shocks. The potential impact of September the 11th on consumer confidence, the greater scale of accounting and corporate governance scandals in the US than in Europe. But despite that, it is Europe's performance which has been poor, while the US's has been surprisingly robust. European Union growth has been 0.7% in 2002, the US is 2.4%, and almost all forecasts suggest a similar differential in America's favor in 2003. Now, Euro-skeptics find that totally unsurprising. This pattern, they say, reflects deep-rooted rather than short-term factors. Europe, they say, has grown more slowly than the US for 20 years. It has failed to achieve a productivity spurt from the application of information technology, and it is uncompetitive because of high taxes, barriers to free competition, and inflexible labor markets. And therefore, deep structural reform is essential. Eurosceptics say that, certain that the required reform will never, in fact, occur. But many Europhiles also say it, believing that the needed reform can be achieved. And at European summits over the last 2 years, Lisbon, Stockholm, Barcelona, the debate has focused on how far Europe is willing to embrace the challenge of structural reform. But the purpose of my lecture this evening is to question this conventional wisdom, the use of the word structural reform, or at least, as it were, to deconstruct it. For I think the phrase structural reform, in relation to Europe, and also in relation to Japan, but my focus this evening is Europe, I think the use of that phrase is now used in such an all-embracing, vague, and often polemic sense that it confuses our understanding and can actually misdirect appropriate policy focus. And specifically, I want to argue five propositions this evening. First, that much of the difference in economic performance between the US and Europe reflects not differences in economic efficiency, but in individual and social choice, which are unlikely to be influenceable by any policy initiatives, and which indeed, arguably, we should not attempt to change, since the purpose of liberal economics is to maximize the choices available to people, not to tell people how they should exercise that choice. Second, that the product market liberalization agenda of the Lisbon, Stockholm, and Barcelona summits, while positive, is of marginal importance to Europe's future prosperity. Third, that the idea that Europe must cut taxes and welfare spending in order to be more competitive is largely wrong. Fourth, that the problems now facing the Eurozone economy, and in particular Germany and Italy, result primarily from deficiencies in the Eurozone macro policy framework. Fifth, however, that Europe does face one huge long-term structural challenge, pension system sustainability in the face of an aging population, a challenge with very little relevance to economic prospects this year or next, but with huge implications for European society over the next 50 years. My overall theme, therefore, is that European policy discussion often fails to focus on the most important issues. What I will not pretend, however, is that this lecture provides a full description of Europe's economic problems or their solutions. It omits, for instance, any discussion of skills and the science base, creative industries and entrepreneurship, industrial clusters, or the management of public services, all important issues. And I've said that to preempt anybody in question saying, "Ah, but you haven't mentioned the most important thing." There's lots of things I haven't mentioned. My aim is not to be comprehensive, but simply to challenge some specific common beliefs about the Europe versus America comparison, and to do so as a deliberate stimulus to debate. Let's begin with the facts. Stepping back from growth last year or this, what long-term picture are we trying to explain? Well, clearly, as this slide shows, Europe has grown on the top two lines more slowly than the US for at least 20 years, a growth rate of 2.2% over the last 21 years versus 3.1% in the US. But note on the bottom two rows that almost all of that difference disappears if we look not at absolute GDP growth, but at GDP growth per capita. And with the difference in absolute growth almost entirely explained by the fact that the US population is still growing at about 1% per annum, whereas the European population is growing at about 0.3% per annum. As machines for delivering increasing prosperity to individuals, these two continental economies actually are very similar. They perform roughly the same. Almost exactly equivalent over the period 1980 to 1995, and with the US moving a bit ahead in the late 1990s. A pattern which is clearer still if we look at productivity per hour worked. Until the early 1990s, the European Union was increasing productivity and, as a result, hourly wage rates far more rapidly than the US. But in the late 1990s, there was a turnaround, the US enjoying a strong productivity spurt, European productivity slowing, though still faster than America's in the early 1990s and 1980s. As for unemployment, what we see is a mirror image of the productivity picture. The US's low productivity growth in the 1980s and 90s, matched by a long and sustained fall in unemployment. The EU's high productivity growth in the 1980s and early 90s, accompanied by very poor employment creation. European unemployment then coming down in the late 1990s, with strong employment growth in some major countries, Spain and France, for instance, though notably not in Germany, but with Europe's unemployment rate still appreciably above US levels. So that overall, summing up, we are not trying to explain a sustained and general failure of the European economy over a number of decades, but two things. First, why the US achieved a productivity spurt in the late 1990s while Europe did not. Second, why Europe has tended to combine high productivity growth with low employment growth. Though with a caveat even on that summary, Europe's economic performance is not homogeneous. Several European economies have, since 1993, for instance, achieved per capita growth rates similar to or ahead of the US. Ireland, Finland, Spain, Sweden, Netherlands, Denmark. An interesting list, both in the number, but also in the diversity of the type of countries which are there. And Europe's labour market performance is hugely diverse, with several economies, notably Scandinavian economies, achieving employment rates as high as the USA, while some countries, notably the Mediterranean ones, have really startlingly low employment rates. So it's a diverse picture, but still with those two overall questions worth asking. Why overall a European failure to match America's productivity spurt? Why overall poor labour market performance? Let's begin with productivity. And before we turn to the last 5 or 6 years, it's important to get the bigger picture clear. And one thing the big picture reveals is a big difference between the USA and Europe, not in efficiency, but in social choice. This slide compares France and the US in 1999. The US then, over on the right-hand side, GDP per capita, the US at that stage was something like 40% better off in measured GDP per capita terms. That difference derived from two factors: 21% higher output per person employed and 15% higher employment per head of population. But the higher output per person employed was in turn explained by American workers working 18% more hours per employee than French, with the difference in productivity per hour worked, which is up here, 102 versus 100, a trivial difference easily within the margins of error of these calculations. So that overall, all of the prosperity difference between the US and France is explained by a difference in the total hours worked per head of population, and none of it is explained by measured efficiency per hour worked. And that means that if these lower hours are freely chosen by French people, then the difference between French and US GDP per capita is a product of choice, not of efficiency. French people choosing a different trade-off between leisure and additional income. So are those lower hours freely chosen? Well, some of them clearly are not. those which result from involuntary unemployment or from involuntary early retirement are not a product of social choice, but of labour market inefficiency. And France's higher unemployment rate would suggest that, say, 5 of the 15-point difference in employees per head of population is involuntary. But the best evidence from French public opinion surveys, and from, for instance, their reaction to the 35-hour week legislation, is that the greater part of this difference in work-leisure trade-off is freely chosen. And if it is, if French people are happier with more leisure but less income than Americans, then no liberal economist should criticize them for that choice, the aim of liberal economics being to ensure that the economy achieves efficient frontiers of production and efficient frontiers of utility preference functions, but not to tell individuals where along those utility preference functions they should make their own trade-offs. And what is true of France is true of the rest of Europe. In almost all European countries, indeed I think in all European countries, with one exception, with one area exception, hours worked per employee are below US levels and are falling. The only exception being Scandinavian countries, where hours worked were already far below American levels even 20 years ago, and where they're not falling further, but where they are much lower. In America, no such fall, this is the bottom line down here, has occurred. American hours worked per employee pretty much stable at about 18.30 per year. Now, why this major divergence in social preference is an interesting issue. And I have to say that on the basis of almost any theory of utility preference that you can put forward, it is the American behavior which it is more difficult to explain. A society getting steadily richer, but totally focused on more income, not more leisure. But for the purposes of this evening, we don't need to debate which of these choices is the right one, or the better one, or the more natural one. We simply need to draw the obvious implication. The fact that Europe's GDP per capita growth has been marginally below the US's for 20 years is not a sign of inferior economic performance, but reflects the fact that Europeans have chosen to turn increased productivity into a mix of greater leisure and greater income, whereas Americans have turned it solely into greater income. Second big picture point before we focus on the last 5 or 6 years. These are the productivity trends over the last 50 years for the US, three leading European economies, and Japan. Just in case you can't see the scale there, that is the US. This is France and West Germany. This is total Germany being measured from here. This is the UK, and this is Japan. And the story is one of catch-up by some, but not by others. Catch-up by France and West Germany to US levels between the 1960s and the 1990s, but noticeably not catch-up by Britain, a slight closing of the gap in the 1980s and 90s, but still well below US, French, and West German levels, and indeed with a rate of catch-up which would take 60 years or so to close the gap. And it's worth spelling that out because in itself it should throw, I think, quite a big bucket of cold water over some of the conventional wisdom diagnosis of Europe's problems. Continental Europe, it is claimed, needs to copy the successful model of the UK's liberalised product and labour markets in order to catch up with the US leader. This slide would suggest that the answer is a good deal more complex than that. But also, the truth is not quite as favourable to France or Germany, or indeed Britain, as this chart would suggest. For whereas this slide shows France and West Germany on a par with the US, and a US acceleration in the 1990s so slight that we can't even make it out visually amid these overlapping lines, these figures are for the whole economy, including the state sector of the economy. And if we narrow down our focus to the private market sector of the economy, we find a more significant US advantage, both in terms of level of productivity and in terms of growth of productivity. Thus, Omani and De Boer's latest figures for the National Institute productivity study suggest substantial American advantages in major sectors such as manufacturing, transport and communications, and distributive trades, and suggest a major acceleration of US productivity growth in the market sector of the economy in the late 1990s, an acceleration not matched in Europe. And the issue therefore remains, First, why does the USA appear to achieve higher productivity levels than all European countries in some specific market-oriented sectors? And secondly, what did happen to US productivity in the 1990s? Why do these Bureau of Labor Statistics figures, for instance, show the trend growth rate accelerating from only 1.4% for the 20 years prior to 1995 to 2.4% in the last seven or so years? And why didn't Europe share this acceleration? Is this evidence of sclerotic, overtaxed, uncompetitive Europe unable to grasp the potential of IT investment? Well, one way to answer that is to break down the difference, both in level and in growth rate, by sector. And that sectoral breakdown suggests, once again, that differences in social choice may be as important as any European failure in absolute economic efficiency. This slide sets out, on the left, O'Mahony and Du Bois' decomposition of the productivity gap between the US and the UK, and on the right, my own estimates using their figures for the gap between the US and Germany. And from both comparisons, one sector, this sector here, leaps out. Distributive trades, retailing and wholesaling. Lower productivity in retailing and wholesaling accounts for over a third of the total productivity gap between the UK and the US, and for well over half of the gap between Germany and the US. And that finding of the dominance of distributive trades in productivity gap comparisons holds true for Europe in general, and indeed for Japan. Other advanced countries managed to get reasonably close to US productivity in sectors like manufacturing, in utilities, and even in finance and business services, but almost all of them fall well short of the US in retailing and wholesaling. In Japan, for instance, in the specific sector of manufacturing, you have incredibly high productivity rates, but in the whole of retailing and wholesaling, you have productivity rates which are only 50% of American levels. Now, why? Well, I actually think the answer is fairly obvious, and I think it's rooted in deeply physical facts, which is that it is simply far easier to run retailing and wholesaling distribution at a high level of efficiency in a lightly populated, dispersed physical environment such as the US than in more densely populated Europe or Japan. Physical space has a pervasive impact on many aspects of productivity, but above all in those sectors concerned with the physical movement of goods. In-store retail management is more efficient if you have aisles in your store wide enough to allow restocking without consumer service degradation, so that you can restock during the day rather than having to do it expensively overnight. Back-of-store handling efficiencies are far easier to achieve if you have large trucks coming at predictable times, having travelled along uncongested freeways and turning round in wide spaces, much easier than it is with smaller trucks arriving at unpredictable times and queuing to use constricted unloading bays. Productivity is increased if average pack size is bigger, because consumers have bigger fridges located in bigger kitchens in bigger houses. Size, it turns out, matters. Physical space matters. And in all sorts of subtle but inherent ways, America gets a productivity advantage from the fact that only a small proportion of its population lives in dense urban clusters which dominate the economic geography of England, the Netherlands, Germany, Italy, or Japan. The only European country which comes close to America in measured productivity in the retailing and wholesaling sectors is France. And that's because France has lower population density and as a result has been more willing to allow large out-of-town retailing developments of the sort common in the US. France has close to US levels of retailing productivity because the outskirts of French towns look more like the outskirts of American towns than anywhere else in Europe. So physical space is, I believe, a major driver of the difference in the level of European and US productivity. But while physical space could explain an inherent difference in productivity level, it is less obvious that it could explain the difference in recent growth rates. Less obvious, but perhaps surprisingly possible. Why has US productivity growth accelerated? Much attention has focused on the impact of information technology, both in its own production industries and in its use. Thus, work by Van Ark, Inclar and McGookin shows the acceleration of total US productivity in the 1990s from 1.1% to 2.2%, explained by two factors. First, a slight acceleration in productivity growth in IT-producing industries from 6.1% to 6.5%, an effect on the total amplified by the fact that those IT-producing industries, the manufacture of semiconductors, PCs and mobile phones, were growing as a percentage of the total economy. Second, a major acceleration in productivity growth in those sectors intensive in their use of ICT from 1.4% to 4.2%, with those sectors of the economy which were neither ICT producers nor intensive ICT users showing no acceleration at all. Van Ark and Co. then compare this with European figures with two interesting findings. First, that the Europeans have actually achieved quite as fast a growth in productivity in ICT production. Nokia's mobile phone factories, it turns out, are quite as good as Motorola's. Second, however, that Europe has failed to achieve accelerated productivity growth in those sectors which are intensive in their use of ICT. But when they then look at which specific sectors are failing to achieve this ICT-based productivity leap, they arrive at a quite startling result, which is that 80% of the entire difference in productivity growth rates between Europe and the US is located in retailing and wholesaling in the distributive trades we saw earlier. Over the last 5 to 7 years, US productivity in retailing and wholesaling has been growing at an absolutely dramatic 6% per annum, while European growth rates have been only 1% or so. And that fact alone seems to account for the majority, and indeed for the vast majority, of the entire difference in growth performance we're trying to explain. So why has US retailing and wholesaling achieved such a productivity spurt? The answer seems to lie in a combination of ICT-based redesign facilitated by use of physical space, by ease of greenfield development. All studies of the US retailing productivity phenomenon stress the importance of new build of very large discount stores by Walmart, Home Depot, Best Buy, Circuit City, and the like. And one major study, indeed, finds that all, not just some, but all of the productivity growth in US retailing in the 1990s is attributable to the new entry of new, more efficient retailing establishments, new stores on new sites, and that none is attributable to productivity improvement within already existing sites of stores. Big new stores on greenfield sites achieved huge productivity improvements, partly from the use of ICT, partly from exploiting the inherent physical advantages of large site operation, and partly from the combination of the two, barcode-based logistics systems dramatically cutting inventory levels in those circumstances where replenishment time can be predicted because of freely moving roads and uncongested back-of-store handling. In Europe, this didn't happen. And if these studies are right, that fact alone explains the vast majority of Europe's widening productivity gap versus the US. And it didn't happen because large out-of-town new entry is irrelevant to retailing competition in the densest urban environments, because planning restrictions limit large out-of-town development where it is potentially relevant, and because our roads are congested. Even in France, where the 1970s and 80s saw an explosion of an earlier generation of out-of-town developments, the freedom to open new, still larger stores has been restricted in the 1990s. And French retailing productivity, while higher than elsewhere in Europe, is now growing as slowly as elsewhere in Europe. Elsewhere in Europe, planning restrictions are tighter still. So what implications follow from this for policy? Well, some would say the implication is clear. Get rid of these planning restrictions and seize this productivity potential. Let neither NIMBY opposition to hypermarkets in Hampshire or Italian small shop owners lobbying against supermarkets on the edge of Florence stand in the way of productivity and prosperity. And certainly the link between planning rules and productivity, and between planning rules and ease of competitive entry and thus competitive intensity, is a fertile policy issue. But Europe's planning restrictions are not there for arbitrary reasons. They express consumer preferences for preserved countryside and preserved urban communities. And they are more restrictive than in the US because there is less space than in the US. So that again we face an issue not just of economic efficiency, but of consumer and social choice, and one where the difference between the US and Europe is easy to understand. The more crowded the environment, the more value you would logically place on environmental preservation, and the lower, everything else being equal, will be the utility-maximizing productivity level in any sector where there exists a trade-off between measured productivity and environmental quality. Both the productivity gap between Europe and the US and the increase in that gap in the late 1990s may therefore be significantly determined by social choices which it is unlikely that we could change or perhaps should seek to change. Now, given that analysis, which may be overstated, but it would need to be overstated a hell of a lot for this not to be at least part of the story, given that analysis, how well targeted and how relevant is the liberalisation agenda being pursued by Europe and urged upon Europe by the British government? The answer, I believe, is that the product market liberalisation on which much of the attention is focused is useful, worth pursuing, but unlikely to make more than a marginal difference to the gap in productivity level between the US and Europe. The Spanish presidency defined five priorities for the Barcelona summit in March 2002. Strengthening European networks, liberalising energy and financial service markets, reforming European labour markets, and improving Europe's education and science base. But within these five, it was on energy liberalisation that most attention focused. And the surrounding rhetoric to this summit stressed the vital character of these reforms. Progress on economic reform in general, but on energy liberalisation in particular, was argued, essential to kickstart the European economy. If Europe failed on this due to French intransigence over energy liberalisation, doubts would be cast on the credibility of the entire reform programme and Europe's growth would suffer. But these statements strike me as largely nonsense for two reasons. First, because I think they confuse short-term conjunctural effects with long-term effects. No supply-side structural change ever kickstarts the short-term growth prospects of an economy. Secondly, because they vastly overstate the importance of the energy sectors, even in the long term. The importance of the energy sectors to the productivity gap between Europe and the US is trivial. In those decomposition figures, it just doesn't show up as an important part of the difference. The correlation across Europe between low energy prices to industry and degrees of energy market liberalisation is mildly positive, but only mildly. The total benefit to the European economy of energy market liberalisation, in a sector accounting for no more than 2 to 3% of GDP, could not possibly amount to more than a small fraction of 1% of GDP, a benefit which would accrue only over the long term and which would have no impact on the growth rate this year or next. The case for energy market liberalisation is on balance a good one, but it is frankly no more than a marginal issue in the economic history of Europe. Financial service liberalisation and airline competition, which were two of the other ones on the previous page, are somewhat more important. Financial services productivity does show up as a significant driver of the productivity gap for some European countries, and there are major efficiencies in European financial service delivery which fiercer competition might well shake out. But frankly, what is striking, looking at the totality of this agenda, is how slight it is relative to the rhetoric of far-reaching liberalisation, or relative to the size of the productivity gap which opened up between the US and Europe in the late 1990s. But I believe that that is not due to some failure or imagination or will on the part of European politicians. Instead, I think it reflects two facts. First, that most of the potential for spurring productivity through product market liberalisation has already been seized through the single market programme of the late 1980s, through the privatisations and domestic liberalisations pursued by governments across Europe, and through the telecoms and postal services liberalisations already agreed at European level. Second, that the key drivers of the remaining productivity gap arise in sectors where physical constraints are important and where the key policy trade-offs to be made, for instance on land planning, need to reflect trade-offs at local level, which are and should be matters of national or regional rather than European level competence. One of the five items on the Barcelona agenda, economic agenda, reforming labour markets, is clearly, however, very important. Europe's productivity failure has been greatly overstated and is concentrated in particular sectors with particular characteristics. But some European labour markets do suffer from a more pervasive and long-lasting problem, a tendency towards high levels of unemployment even during periods of rapid growth. In the interest of time, however, and because it's a huge and complex issue in itself, I'm only going to make one general comment on that issue this evening, which is to repeat that Europe does not have a labour market problem. Some countries in Europe have different national problems. Italy has one, Denmark does not. Therefore, their cause cannot be European-wide factors, such as relatively high taxes or legislation introduced by the European Union. Instead, labour market problems arise from complex combinations of multiple different factors: the level of minimum wages, the ease of hire and fire, the ease of part-time working, the nature of wage-fixing processes, and the generosity and the conditionality of unemployment benefit. Those combinations are nationally specific, and so too must be the solutions. But the fact that in some countries there is a major problem and that their solution will require political courage is, I believe, clear. In this area, at least, difficult structural reforms are needed in some countries. But such changes in European labour markets do not need to be accompanied by wholesale dismantling of European welfare states to allow tax cuts required to make European economies competitive. The belief that it is needed is, however, a mainstay of journalistic commentary and of business lobby group belief. Europe, and Germany in particular, the argument goes, simply have too high labour costs, partly because of higher wages, but primarily because of high non-wage labour costs. German labour costs on this slide, 10% or so higher than American, because of about 45% higher social security charges. Therefore, European economies must cut taxes to become competitive. But this is at very least overstated and arguably quite wrong. Germany may indeed have a problem of too high labour costs. But if it does, this is not due to structural factors common throughout Europe, but to macroeconomic factors specific to Germany. In general, high payroll taxes need not and usually do not create a competitiveness problem for two reasons. The first is that, at least if labour markets are reasonably flexible, the true incidence of payroll taxes falls not on employer costs, but on the wages of employees, workers receiving a lower wage rate than they would if payroll taxes were lower. Payroll taxes, though nominally falling on employers, are, in flexible labour markets, no different in their effective incidence than income taxes. And the fact that, say, Sweden has higher payroll taxes than Britain should in theory mean simply that Swedish wages are lower than they otherwise would be, Swedish citizens receiving more of their remuneration in collective government expenditure and less in a direct wage form. And indeed, not only is that true in theory, but the fact that Sweden is a highly competitive economy with a robust external position and achieving a high rate of employment suggests that it is true in practice also. But even if this were not the case, the second reason for doubting this competitiveness argument would still apply, which is that in a floating exchange rate system, any imbalance produced by a combination of high payroll taxes and labour market inflexibilities can be offset by a decline in the exchange rate. The idea that the whole Eurozone, with an externally floating exchange rate, can suffer a competitiveness problem is indeed a general theoretical confusion, and the concept of high taxes creating such a competitiveness problem just a specific subset of that confusion. But clearly it is possible for a specific country within a fixed exchange rate regime of European Monetary Union to be, at least for a transitional period, in a state of competitive disequilibrium, particularly if it has relatively inflexible labour markets in which downward adjustments of nominal wages will be resisted. And it is possible that Germany is in that position, having entered the euro at too high an exchange rate. How far that is the case is debatable, but certainly we should recognise that it is a possible result of entry into a fixed exchange rate regime, a risk inevitably present in the initial creation of a monetary union that one country, or some countries within the system, will be locked in at an uncompetitively high exchange rate. So it is possible that German total labour costs are now too high, and one way to reduce them would indeed be to reduce non-wage labour costs, i.e. to cut payroll taxes. But another way to cut them would be to reduce wages, illustrating the point that if Germany does now have a problem of uncompetitively high labour cost, the problem is not essentially driven by the burden of tax, but by an exchange rate set too high. Finland in the euro and Sweden outside it have equally high non-wage labour costs, but no evidence of a competitive disequilibrium of the sort which may be facing Germany. If there is a German labour cost problem, it does not prove the point that European tax burdens are unsustainably high, but it may point us towards a significant problem in the macro policy of the euro system. And it is to macro demand policy issues which I'd now like to turn. For while my focus until now has been on long-term supply-side differences between Europe and the US, it is differences in demand and in the macro policy framework which explain the divergent growth of the last 2 years. And that point needs to be spelled out clearly, precisely because, I think rather bizarrely, it is frequently denied. Over the last 2 years, Eurozone growth has severely disappointed expectations, growing by only 1.6% in 2001 and 0.7% in 2002, with growth in the zone's largest economy, Germany, lower still at 0.6% and 0.3%. The US, despite the shocks I talked of earlier, has grown far more robustly. And the reason for Europe's disappointing performance is not a failure of competitiveness, nor structural problems depressing the capacity of economies, but inadequate domestic demand. Eurozone exports, for instance, have actually performed better than American or British. On the left, we have exports year-on-year change, and we see Eurozone coming down, but by nothing like as much as UK and US. And net exports on the right-hand side have continued to make a positive contribution to growth. But the domestic demand contribution to Eurozone growth has plummeted, with household consumption, household borrowing, retail sales, car sales, whatever measure of domestic demand you care to choose, far lower in the Eurozone than in the US and falling faster. And what is true for the Eurozone as a whole is even more true of Germany, the slowest growing of the large European economies. German export performance, for all the talk of a competitiveness problem, has actually been remarkably resilient over the last 2 years. But consumption expenditure has fallen, and overall real domestic demand, is down in each of the last 2 years. Yes, Germany has some long-term structural problems, but these are not the cause of Germany's present slow growth. German nominal GDP has risen only 2% per annum in the last 2 years, US nominal GDP by 3.5 to 4%, the UK by almost 5%. And that, not structural problems, is the fundamental reason why the German economy has grown slowly over the last 2 years. And that slow growth in nominal demand derives from the combination of fiscal and monetary policy and is rooted in the macro policy rules of the euro system and the fiscal positions of countries at the time of entry. Now, to many people here, the demon is the Stability and Growth Pact, which limits public deficits to 3% of GDP and which is therefore forcing Germany to tighten fiscal policy this year, a move which will make Germany's recession worse and which could provoke a dangerous spiral of falling prices and falling demand, a classic deflation trap. And there are good arguments for recasting the Stability Pact, basing it, for instance, on cyclically adjusted measures of deficits. But I don't think we should fool ourselves that the problems derive solely from an ill-designed set of rules. For some set of rules, either on deficits or on accumulated debt levels, is, I think, essential to ensure the solvency of European governments within a monetary system where nations have surrendered the ability to inflate their way out of debt traps. And almost any set of rules would curtail today's freedom of fiscal maneuver of major Eurozone countries given the fiscal positions with which they entered the euro. The Maastricht limit on accumulated stock of debt, which was meant to be less than 60% of GDP, and the Stability Pact guidance on structural deficits, ideally to be about zero at the midpoint of the cycle, were not and are not pointless masochism, but actually rather good Keynesian guidelines, which, if they had been met, would now give countries the freedom to allow automatic fiscal stabilizers to operate. The problem is not that those rules were set, but that they were not met. Italian gross government debt at 100%, and possibly actually rising this year, is far above the 60% guideline. And I think the interpretation which said that it was in line with the guideline because it was clearly heading towards it has to rank as one of the more generous interpretations of a guideline that anybody has ever put forward. And because of that level of accumulated debt, Italy's ability to provide fiscal stimulus will be severely limited for many years to come, whatever technical adjustments are made to the stability pact. And the fact that the major Eurozone economies entered the global economic slowdown with significant structural deficits was bound to limit their freedom for fiscal response and thus to depress nominal demand, however the details of the SGP were designed. Yes, we should reform the Stability and Growth Pact, but we have to face the facts. Failure fully to meet the Maastricht convergence criteria before going ahead with the euro has introduced a potentially dangerous constraint on fiscal policy response and is the key cause of the Eurozone's poor performance over the last 2 years. If fiscal policy is inevitably constrained, the burden of policy response falls on monetary policy. And what constraints? Monetary policy, provided it is pursued aggressively enough, should always be able to maintain nominal demand growth at reasonable levels, either via interest rate policy, or if the zero bound of zero interest rates is reached, via government debt monetization. But this potential capability needs to be guided by appropriate targets, and there is, I believe, an overwhelming case that the ECB's current inflation target of 0 to 2% is significantly too low. There is no science to setting an optimal inflation target, but it should be high enough to provide some lubrication to real wage flexibility and to give the central bank the option, when needed, of setting interest rates at a negative real level, while low enough to prevent a cycle of increasing inflationary expectations. Something like 2 to 3% is almost certainly a better inflation target than 0 to 2%. And there are two specific reasons for nudging the target higher still in the specific conditions of the Eurozone. The first is the danger that entry exchange rates could be fixed wrong, which we saw was the real issue in relation to German labour costs. This argues for ensuring a reasonable level of inflation even in the lowest inflation countries. If Germany does need to adjust real wages down, it will do so more easily with mild inflation, avoiding the need for actual nominal wage cuts. The second reason for nudging the target higher is that even the current Eurozone, let alone the potential Eurozone after enlargement, includes countries of significantly different income levels, and that, for some complex reasons to do with differential productivity rates between traded and non-traded sectors of the economy, means that countries in a process of catch-up towards higher income levels, such as Spain or Portugal, or in the future Poland, need to have measured inflation rates above the level appropriate for the richest countries within a fixed exchange rate regime, the so-called Balassa-Samuelson effect. There will be a technical note in the written version of this lecture. If anybody doesn't believe it now, you'll just have to trust me, I'm an economist. My calculations suggest that the optimal inflation rate for Spain, if it was to converge to German standards of living over, say, a 10 to 15 year period with a 4% real growth rate, which should not be impossible, is something like 4%. The optimal inflation rate for Spain is not 2%, it's something like 4%, implying that the ECB should not react to that sort of inflation rate in the catch-up countries, and that its overall Eurozone inflation target needs to be about 0.25% higher to reflect those effects within the existing Eurozone, and perhaps 0.5% higher once you allow for the impact of the new entrants post-enlargement. And it also implies that any attempt to make the new accession countries meet the Maastricht convergence criteria on inflation before entry to the euro will be an economically ludicrous policy, which will simply further depress growth prospects in the European economy. Overall, therefore, I think the case for changing the ECB's target and for making it explicit is overwhelming. And I think it is only macro policy changes, such as a changed ECB approach or greater flexibility within the Stability and Growth Pact, which have the ability to make a difference to Eurozone growth rates over the next few years rather than to long-term growth prospects. Let me sum up. There is a conventional wisdom that Europe's recent poor performance is a sign of deep structural problems which must be addressed by product market liberalisation, by labour market reform, and by the reduction in uncompetitive tax burdens. But against that conventional wisdom, I have argued, first, that the Eurozone's poor growth is primarily caused by macro policy problems and rules which must now be changed. Second, that taxation burdens are not in some general and structural sense unsustainable, though there are some special case issues to do with tax, particularly payroll taxes as they relate to low-income people. Third, that when we look at longer-term differences between Europe and American prosperity and productivity, we need to recognize the impact of physical environment and social choice, and that within this context, while the European Union's product market liberalization agenda is positive and sensible, it is unlikely to have more than a marginal impact. Fourth, however, that some European labor markets are seriously inefficient and should be reformed. Provided such a policy mix is pursued, macro stimulation, national labor market reform, and useful but not transformational product market liberalization, Europe should continue to grow GDP per capita roughly in line with the US, but at a permanently lower level, and with US absolute GDP growth continuing to outstrip European because of higher population growth. Now, I can see no reason why the key choices that Europe makes to sacrifice some productivity potential in order to protect its urban and rural environment and to take some of the benefits of productivity growth and increased leisure are now or will be in the future unsustainable. National and continental economies do not compete with one another in the normal sense of the word compete, and societies have wide degrees of freedom to make their own social and economic trade-offs. Provided Europeans understand the consequences of their trade-offs, for instance, that shorter hours mean lower GDP per capita, there is nothing inherently unsustainable about that choice. But choices could be unsustainable if the link between choice and consequence is too indirect and too long-term to allow informed decisions. And there is one set of European social choice, there's one European social choice which is unsustainable, which is the current combination of birth rates, retirement ages, and explicit or implicit pension promises. Europe's rapidly aging population will, unless average retirement ages rise significantly, produce soaring dependency ratios and will lead to increases in public spending on pensions, which would push tax levels to unsustainable levels and would place huge strains on corporate pension provision or leave many pensioners with inadequate provision in old age. On pensions, European citizens are making decisions and assumptions which are unsustainable. The possible solution to this huge challenge are beyond the scope of this lecture, but the scale of the challenge is clear. The argument that deep and difficult structural reform is required to the European social model is often overstated, but not in relation to retirement ages and pension provision. All of which implies a very different ordering of Europe's economic priorities than implied by the agenda of economic reform summits. At those summits, the Eurozone macro framework has received limited attention. The aging population and pensions, only the most general discussions, yet those are the most important issues we face, the one short term, the other long term. Labour market reform is discussed, but in general rather than specific terms, while product market liberalisation receives top billing, even though the concrete proposals under discussion could only make a minor difference to long-term growth prospects and almost none to growth this year or next. Well, why that disconnect? The reason is clear. European Union summits talk specifically about product market liberalisation because the European Union has a specific competence in that area. They talk only in general terms about labour markets because the specific actions required are for national governments. They avoid macro issues because the Maastricht Treaty gives the ECB independence as to specific objectives, as well as independence in the pursuit of those objectives. And they largely avoid the pension issue because that too is a national issue, extremely long-term and very sensitive. The European Union can only do what it is empowered to do. The specific agendas reflect its competence, and of necessity, to a degree, always will. But I think it is important to change the priorities, if not necessarily of European summits, then of the wider economic reform debate. And important, finally, to recognize the consequences of the social choices which Europe is making, even if having recognized them, we stick with them. I have in this lecture been fairly positive to Europe's social choices, its preference for a mix of leisure and income, rather than income alone, and his preference for preserved rural and urban environments over those final few points of productivity potential. Those choices seem to me perfectly natural preferences for rich societies to make. I think the measure of economic success should be income per hour worked rather than absolute economic growth. And I think sensible societies may well sacrifice even some income per hour worked in favour of environmental objectives. But these choices do have consequences for absolute economic growth, and absolute economic growth has consequences for geopolitical power. And the choices which Europe is explicitly or implicitly making on its birth rate, on immigration, on leisure and hours worked, and on physical planning, quite apart from the other decisions that it is making on defence expenditure as a percent of GDP, are driving and will continue to drive a major shift in the relative economic and geopolitical power of the US and Europe. Under any reasonable scenario, given the trends which are occurring in US versus European population, magnified by the trends in productivity, magnified by the trends in hours worked, US absolute GDP growth is going to outstrip Europe's significantly over the next several decades. Europe, I believe, is making social choices which are rational and natural for human beings in mature, already rich, and peaceable societies. But one consequence of those choices is bound to be a loss of geopolitical power in a world which is not quite as peaceable as we would wish. Thank you very much.
Well, I hope you agree that's a suitably provocative beginning to the lecture series. We've only unfortunately got about a quarter of an hour for discussion because there's a reception to follow the lecture. So there should be roving microphones around. So I now invite questions to the speaker.
Thank you. On, yeah. Bernard Casey from London School of Economics. Two points, one very brief. I noticed the difference in productivity between the market sector and non-market sector that you referred to earlier on. It seemed that one of the consequences of that, or one of the implications of that, was that non-market sector productivity in Europe was a lot higher than in the USA. So are we actually better at providing public services? More importantly, however, with respect to these trade-offs in the end between work and leisure, some of those are trade-offs between work and retirement and the ability to support aging societies. Yes, we have to make some kind of trade-off. Yes, there are large implicit deficits that we are building up thereby. But are you not confident that we have political systems and structures that will enable us to resolve that choice? Do you actually think that what we're doing is putting off and not facing up to those long-term choices precisely because they are long-term and not immediate?
Do you want to take one or two more? Shall I take a couple and then? Yeah, do them together. Yeah.
One more.
Yeah, one more.
We'll take someone up top.
Yana Sandi from Emerging Markets Partnership. I'm an LSE alumni in regional and urban planning. And I have a question about your analysis of the spatial density related to... I'm upstairs, I'm here.
Oh, yes, hello. I was trying to see where you are. Yeah.
So I have a question related to your analysis of spatial density related to productivity. Because on one hand, it's understandable why functions such as retail and wholesale might benefit from a lower density. But it is also well known that increased density produces increased value in terms of the service economy, innovation, basically the services. And as an example, the northern part of Italy and the region that's called Blue Banana is a highly dense area and characterized by very high productivity. So have you looked at maybe the offsetting effects and perhaps if that is not the answer, maybe there is something else happening.
Okay, 3 points there. First of all, you are absolutely right. That was a very quick piece of mathematics to note that there's a major difference, both in level and in growth rate, between the comparison between the total economy and the market sectors of the economy. Indeed, in fact, the figures come really in three different slices. They come in state sectors versus business sectors, and then in the work of Amani and De Boer, they define a thing called market sectors, where they take out of the US figures the health sector, because although that is a market sector in the US, it is not a market sector in Europe. And that turns out to be very significant, because actually US productivity growth in the health service has been very slow indeed. Now, there's a major issue of whether that's just a measurement issue, whether we just don't know how to measure productivity in health services. But according to you, whether you take these three measures, you get different results. I find it actually very difficult to interpret what productivity in the state sectors mean. I think what we have to accept is that once you get down to productivity in a specific market-oriented sector like retailing, whether we think, you know, it's the end of the story in terms of, you know, consumer preference and utility, it is actually measuring something definitive. How you measure productivity in government administration or defense or even education, I think, is much more problematic. And therefore, I think we almost have to take the fact that the total economy figures are more favorable to Europe, but then there isn't much we can conclude from that. The only stuff that we can really conclude, I think, you're grimacing, but I think it's a very tricky issue, and certainly I haven't managed to crack what sense to make of the mathematical fact that we seem to be doing better on non-business sectors of the economy. It's obviously a major issue. On pensions, I mean, basically I said, I think that this is where Europe is fooling itself. I don't think people are fooling themselves in terms of hours worked. If people, you know, if French people want to work fewer hours for lower GDP per capita, that's their choice. And it truly is the evidence that that is their choice. But I think if you simply take the totality of the implicit or explicit pension promises that, for instance, Italians receive from the Italian state, they are not deliverable given present levels of retirement or present levels of taxation. Broadly speaking, one thing has to give. Either the working population has to make an increasing contribution, or the retired population has to have lower levels of income, or the retirement age has to change. That's the sort of iron law of pensions, which is not actually changed by technical issues like funded versus non-funded. I am worried that so far those issues are being avoided by some governments around Europe, or that they are issues which they find very difficult to put onto the agenda and resolve on the agenda because of strong vested interests or different points of view. Some countries around Europe are dealing with them. I think if you look at what the Swedes are doing on average retirement ages, you will find that they are to a significant extent dealing with the system. But I am concerned that that is where the unsustainability of the existing model lies, and that so far the political processes are not clearly on a path to resolve it. You're absolutely right that the issue of the impact of physical space on productivity is much more complicated than I suggested, and indeed there is a bit in the written text of the lecture, which I had to cut for reasons of time, which says Europe will never, I think, end up with the same level of measured retailing productivity in, you know, small stores in the middle of Florence to that which is achieved in the out-of-store layout of a large American town. But Europe has got to, and in some areas of Europe already does, turn its dense urban environments from being disadvantages in some areas to advantages in others. And as a basis for tourism, for design-intensive industries, for education, for science activities, for art, actually dense cities have quite a lot of advantages over incredibly spatially dispersed economic geographies. And I think indeed Northern Italy is very interesting in that respect of a densely populated and in particular dense urban environments with, however, high overall levels of productivity, but with retailing productivity in that area undoubtedly way below American. So we have to turn it round and use it
exploit the advantages which exist within the urban geography of densely populated Europe, and not fool ourselves that Europe becomes prosperous through simply being a carbon copy of the US, because it never will.
I think we've got time maybe for two or three more questions. Must be some people who think that what Adair is saying is completely wrong, so maybe there's one of them.
I don't think what Adair is saying is completely wrong, but I do think there is an issue which he has just mentioned, which is much more wide-ranging into this in relation to this kind of decomposition at a micro level than he acknowledges. And that is, he, like so many people talking about macro issues, is using national accounts statistics as if they were facts. And the truth is they're not, and that becomes clearer as you go down to a more decomposed level. Let me give two examples.
Yep.
One is, Adair has just said that retail productivity is a fact in a way that government productivity is not. Actually, it's not a fact. We don't attempt to measure retail output at all. It's simply proxied by the volume of retail goods. And the effect of that is that if I shift my purchases from Waitrose to Asda, or rather, Asda has higher productivity than Waitrose because its margin is lower. And if I shift my purchases from Waitrose to Asda, that raises productivity in these statistics,
yep.
although that manifestly isn't really what's going on. That's even more extreme in relation to the ICT sector, where a very large part of the so-called productivity gain in the United States is driven by the simple fact that there has been a large increase in ICT expenditure in the United States. Whether that ICT expenditure has increased US output or benefited in any way is a separate question, which is not actually measured in these figures. And you emphasize the division between productivity and ICT using and ICT producing sector. That division in turn is completely determined by what you think has happened to the price of ICT equipment, in which there are wildly different assumptions made as between Britain and the United States.
Yep.
One's building a whole superstructure of explanation on data, a lot of which does not actually bear the weight which is often put on it.
I'm going to take a question from upstairs. I think the questions have to be a bit shorter if we're going to compress them into the time. There should be a mic coming to you just up there.
When you presented both the supply and demand side of the story and concluded that the differentials between the EU and US would remain, albeit at a lower level in the long term, have you taken into consideration the impact of EU enlargement?
Yeah. I'm really sorry, there are more questions than questions, so
do you take one?
We've got time for it. Yeah, why don't you choose your...
This man's in my sights, so he's
thanks, a very brief question. It has to do with macroeconomics. It seems like you have pointed out that microeconomics themselves can sort these problems that we are facing in Europe. Let's sort of look into monetary policy. There's very little room for monetary policy in Europe to help anyway. And what we, if we compare with the late 80s, where there was a sort of supply-side bottlenecks, it doesn't appear that there are supply-side bottlenecks at the moment. So if we put aside monetary policy, are you suggesting that a way out of this sort of low rate of growth or going towards a higher level of inflation, the 3%, is through fiscal policy? Quite frankly, fiscal policy doesn't seem to be the panacea and the answer to all the problems in Western Europe. So what is the alternative?
Okay. First of all, John Kay is absolutely right in saying that, you know, retail productivity is a nice firm foundation of rock. It's not true. Wherever we deal with productivity, we are dealing with problems of sort of sand in our data and in the interpretation of it. In retailing, there is a retail experience which has a value to people, and if you go from a high-quality retail experience to a lower-quality retail experience, all that the measured productivity figures will ever tell you is that the volume per number of employees has gone up.
and therefore in that area and in all sorts of areas, we have an imperfect ability to measure quality. And the ICT expenditure issue is absolutely right as well. There are some studies which suggest that 0.5% of the difference between the US productivity growth rates and the European productivity growth rates could be explained by differences in the way that the price indices of high-tech, of ICT products are measured in the two national account systems. If you take that along with the retailing thing, we'll have ended up with over-explaining. We can explain 150% of the difference, in which case we'll then have to be searching for why, in every other area, Europe is doing better than the US. So I entirely agree. It is a major problem. I think all that I was trying to do, John, was point out some of the problems, not deal with all of the problems. And I think the retailing story is an interesting story because, at least on the measured figures, it is a very big part of what is going on. On European enlargement, I mean, clearly the mechanical impact of European Union enlargement on any reasonable basis is that it will mathematically lower our measured present level of GDP per capita, but as long as those economies are reasonably successful, it ought to increase our measured growth rate of GDP per capita, because as long as those economies are successful, they ought to be on a process of convergence towards Western European levels of the sort that Spain or Ireland have been on over a number of years. And I don't think I can say more than that. I mean, that is what it will do. I don't think it fundamentally changes much more. I'm not convinced that enlargement is actually all that big a short or even long-term event for Western Europe. I think it's a big event for those countries. And I certainly don't think it's an event still to happen. People talk about the shock of low-wage competition from the accession countries. Well, what you have to remember is that there's basically been pretty close to free movement of goods since, I think it was 1997 or 1998, and accession doesn't actually change that. It establishes free movement of people, in some cases with some delays, but the traded competition has been there for some time. On the macroeconomics, I think you were saying that monetary policy can't make a difference. I mean, I'm not sure I agree with that. I mean, I think that whatever a fiscal policy exists, I mean, let's take the case of Japan.
I meant very briefly that macroeconomic policy has gone to the limit. I mean, interest rates have gone to the floor.
Well, macroeconomic policy has clearly not gone to the limit, first of all, because there are no limits in monetary policy. There's a zero bound of zero interest rates, but beyond that, there is a limitless ability of a central bank to expand inflation through monetization of government debt. Now, I think we're a long way away from that in Europe because we're not actually at the zero bound at the moment. But that fundamental point that at the limit there are no limits to monetary policy is a very important macroeconomic point to understand in relation to what is going on in Japan, where I think the problems of Japan are fundamentally catastrophically bad macroeconomic policy by a combination of the government and the central bank, who have managed to convince themselves that there are limits to the effectiveness of monetary policy where none fundamentally exist. So I don't agree that monetary policy is ever limited. I think where I do agree is that actually how much difference would it have made if the ECB had been following a different policy over the last year or so? Well, of course, I've been suggesting that a target might be, say, 2.5% of a inflation. It would have the marvelous benefit that it would happens to be the one which Gordon Brown had selected, so it might make our Chancellor more favourable to going into the euro. But I happen to think it's a rather good target. Actually, Eurozone inflation at the moment is not far off 2.5% of GDP, but I believe it should probably be higher because I believe there are a set of one-off shocks, which probably means that at the moment we ought to be running inflation towards the top end of, say, a 1.5% to 3.5% range. We ought to be at that point within the euro system at the moment. I think it would have made some difference. I think you're right that we have to accept that we are in a sticky position in Europe. The fiscal constraints that we have got because of failure to go far enough with fiscal consolidation before going into the euro create a difficult period of adjustment, which is a situation we would rather not be in. But I think we should at least make it somewhat better than it would be by having a more sensible target of the European Central Bank.
As I mentioned, there is a reception which is in the Shaw Library on the sixth floor of the old building, to which, unfortunately, only those are invited who know that they are invited. In the meantime, I think that was a really splendid beginning to the lecture series, so please show your appreciation.
Very good. I'm not sure I do agree with everything. Don't you never agree with everything?
That was very good.